today's podcast, we welcome Ali and Tim. We'll discuss disparities that exist in the ASCE7 load combinations. We get to talk about nighttime spectaculars at the Walt Disney Parks, specifically Fantasmic. And we'll throw around a few items that are dangerous, but, you know, as a society, we just accept them. Welcome to The Wrinkled Engineer. I'm Gates. I'm here with Ali and Tim today. It's going to be a fun day. We've got one okay topic, but then one topic that I'm very passionate and love. Our code topic for the day, we're going to talk about some discrepancies between the load combination factors between LRFD and ASD that bother me. The fun topic, though, we're going to talk about Disney theme park shows and some technical, what we think the most technical shows were that we've seen through our years and experience. And I'm passionate about this, and I think it'll be fun. No giveaways, but we're going to talk about Fantasmic because that's my favorite show. So jumping into the code discussion here. With the change to ultimate wind loads, which we've talked about before, it created a discrepancy in load combinations, specifically on allowable stress design. And that is earthquake loads have a coefficient of 0.7 and wind loads have a coefficient of 0.6. Do you see anything wrong with that, Tim?
Not right off the bat.
Not off the bat? Okay.
You fishing for something particular?
So I have some issues with that because at the LRFD, at the ultimate level, those two loads are normalized, both with the same coefficient of 1.0.
Mm-hmm.
But then when you go into allowable stress design, you're getting a 15% reduction in wind load versus seismic load, but no commensurate reduction in material strength. And on material strength, that doesn't bother me too much, but where it really annoys me is on the stability load combinations, where you have 0.9 dead load, 1.0 wind load for LRFD, but then you take that and you go to a 0.6 dead load and a 0.6 live load or wind load. So now they're equated to the same level, knowing that we have some buffer there because wind loads have been exaggerated. So I can do a stability calc. I can calculate uplift or overturning on a foundation in ASD and get it right to that balance point where it's just barely code permissible. I go do that calc in LRFD and it's not allowed. It's going to fail every time. Does that bother you?
So an overturning calculation on, say, like a site wall, for example, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like a CMU wall that's having a wind load on it, that when you do it in ASD, it passes.
Yeah, it's a 0.99 or 1.0, right? Unity between the two. You go do that calc in LRFD because you have that 10% penalty on dead load that doesn't exist in ASD, it fails. And you've got to upsize the foundation. And I recognize that between LRFD and ASD, you're going to have conditions where one is benefited over the other. So a heavy live load floor is better in ASD, whereas a heavy dead load floor is better in LRFD, because of the 1.2 on a dead load factor versus a 1.6 in LRFD for live load. And I get you're going to have ends of the spectrum where those are different, but this is a condition where every calculation you do in stability, whether it's sliding or overturning or uplift, ASD is going to have the advantage.
Yeah.
Seems fishy, right?
Yeah, they didn't equate them properly. When you go into the original, Steel Construction Manual, the 13th edition, the black one, where they went into extra detail to explain how they homologated the whole ASD versus LRFD thing. They created a relationship between the two that they didn't violate anywhere when it came to the phi factors versus the omega factors. And I feel like that's where the problem kind of is here, that they've violated that relationship by just not creating one. But we also know that those instability load combinations are a little bit newer,
It replaced the 1.5 factor of safety that, you know, we used for so long.
It was what, the mid 2000s that those came into being. So it's almost like they just haven't, everything moves glacially at the code level. So,
right. So when I started, we were kind of on the 06 code. And so we were in that transition period. Everybody I worked with that was my mentor had used 1.5 factor of safety. Mm-hmm. And you just relate that, you know, if it's earth pressure overturning or if it's wind or seismic, 1.5 of your dead, you know, your dead load has to be 1.5 times greater than the load being applied. Mm-hmm. But I was, you know, reviewing the code with new eyes. And so the stability equations were still, they were there. And so I used them at times, but I also followed what I was taught. Now, Allie is young enough that she probably has never done an equation with a 1.5 factor of safety.
No, I've only ever used the stability that's in the code. Yep.
So did you notice this discrepancy?
I'll be honest, I didn't. It's just always what I use. But I also, I mean, I'm in Missouri, right, is where we do it. So I don't necessarily, we only do wind and seismic's not relevant. Mm-hmm. So to compare how the two equated back also didn't strike me.
Right.
And then, like, I only use ASD and wood and foundations. And in those cases, it kind of helps you a lot mm-hmm. to get away with less wind. So you're like, yeah, this is great. And I don't really think about it not equating back to LRFD because they're right. very like two different worlds.
And I agree that when you look at it from a seismic wind situation, other than some of the design work I've done in like Hawaii and coastal San Francisco, I haven't had the issue of really competing wind and seismic. The issue I have, though, is to me, this is really a wind issue.
Yeah.
Taking seismic completely out of it, because seismic, to me, it's normalized correctly. You have a 10% reduction in dead load when you're comparing it to the ultimate seismic. And you have a little bit more than a 10%, like a 15% reduction in dead load when you compare it to the earthquake load. And that makes sense to me. I'm a firm believer that LRFD is more statistically sound and has a deeper foundation in how it was designed as a methodology. So I prefer that ASD be less be more conservative than LRFD, simply because I have more trust in LRFD and how it handles variance between loads and material strength. Whereas I feel ASD is way more empirical and they penalize material strength, even though that's the most reliable variable we deal with. And they don't do much to penalize loads, even though those are highly variable. It doesn't.
And the fact is they wouldn't have this problem if they'd gone with 0.7.
Right. If they just made it at parity with seismic. That's what I don't understand.
Because all of those overturn combinations were developed when only seismic was in the ultimate range. But now that they move wind into that range without considering these load combinations, and I don't want to say arbitrarily, but there might have been some statistical analysis that put them at 0.6. And now when they try to align it with the previously existing overturn combinations, it's like they need to go with 0.7 wind, or I don't know, or they
0.55 dead load. Something to get you backed off that, you know, we're not going to use the same dead load.
They don't scale the same.
No, and that seems like that would be the whole point. And mm-hmm. if they don't scale the same because of the statistical analysis, that you would bump the wind up to be just the same as seismic so that it all is neat and tidy. But like I said, I don't like having a calculation that I can do every time in ASD and have it be 15% better than the LRFD option. That doesn't sit right. I'm okay with LRFD being 5% better here and ASD being 5% better over here, but across
every
the board,
time.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense. And it doesn't sit well. And the statistics to me can't prove that out because they should be consistent. They're supposed to be almost equal systems.
Right.
And it's tough. And I don't know.
Write a
I would love to know why this got in there. What was the rationale that made people go, this makes sense?
It's almost like it was rushed in there and that part wasn't considered.
But we've been through two ASCE 7 cycles and three or four IBC cycles, and it's still the same.
based on my brief research that I did on this to prepare, I did read that the wind from the newly factored to correlate it back to how it was in ASD had like a 0.625 mm-hmm. relationship. So instead of keeping it at two decimals, they pushed it back to 0.6.
And I almost would have thought with ASCE 716, we would have saw it move to 0.7 because all the wind loads dropped.
The wind loads did drop.
The coastal areas in Florida where I work, it got higher. So now we have like 4 or 5 times as many stations for weather monitoring. So we have better wind data. So that allowed us to drop wind loads. It seems like that would have been a perfect time to bump it up by point to 0.7. And then there would have been no gain, no loss. And it would have been ratified to the same as seismic. They didn't, but that's my gripe. That's what I'm complaining about today. Any other thoughts on that? Because I really want to get into the next topic.
No, let's write a letter.
Strongly. Yes, if only there was a committee I could join.
right.
Yes. All right. So we have a pretty loose format for this, as we were talking before. My premise for the second half of this show is dealing with what were the shows, what were the special effects you've seen at Disney parks that made you go, oh my goodness, this is the best thing I've ever seen, but impressed you as an engineer. Not the thematic of the show, but that impressed you as an engineer, the how'd they do that, this is amazing moments.
From the guest perspective?
Yes, yeah. From your perspective watching the show, for me, it was Fantasmic. I was 10 years old when that came out. I know, Tim, you were there opening night.
Opening day.
Yeah. What were your emotions from seeing that?
All right.
Opening day.
Gosh, well, I mean, that mist screen thing was new. It's no longer new, but that was a big deal.
Yeah, that was patented, right? That was a patent.
It was. Right there. They used IMAX projectors for that, which, you know, really filled your field of view, and it's something that's, again, not as impressive these days because back then it was done literally with reels of film.
Yeah, I remember this is 1992.
Yes. So digital projection was not a thing. So they had the problem where if the show ever stopped midstream, they had to let the show run full length because you had to basically cycle the film.
It's an analog world, right? It's
yeah. I remember them talking about that needed to be done. But that part was really cool. But it was the coordination of the whole thing, just how you can have so many different disparate types of elements functioning with quickly coming on and off and all coordinating and stuff like that. It was really, really impressive.
Absolutely. What impressed me from an engineering perspective is, yes, all these parts moving together, working as one.
Right.
Every fountain, right, had a specific role, specific shape, specific spread. The lights were specific, right? They were all single use. So red could light a certain section of this fountain and blue could light the second, but you can't change that on the fly. These things are built under the water and they all have a purpose, and to make a show of that magnitude where everything has to be specifically built to do one thing, and shoot, the only thing you control on the fountains is the height, right? The pressure that they actually pump through those things. And so that
leads me... And of
course,
they've since solved all that. But yeah,
right.
Yeah.
So that leads me into... There are 3 versions of Fantasmic. We could contend there are a few sub-versions with some changes. But essentially, version 1.0, Disneyland, 1992, built on Tom Sawyer Island, which is impressive that as a guest, you can walk on the stage during the day, and at night, there's a dragon out there.
Right.
Then version 1.1,
you get that whole "where the heck did that come from?"
Yeah, it's kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Magic. Version 1.1 at Hollywood Studio at Walt Disney World, purpose-built facility for Fantasmic, so the seats are more comfortable, sight lines are a little bit better. You don't have to wait for hours before the show. I mean, you do, but not quite like you did at Disneyland back in the day. But it's a different experience, and I didn't see that until 2004. and I've tried to be objective about the difference between a 10-year-old and a 30-something-year-old seeing the show. But it didn't impress me as much as version 1.0. Now, Ali, you've seen... You didn't see the version 1.0. You've seen 2.0 at Disneyland, correct?
Yep, and I have also seen the one at Disney World.
And so, then we... Two or three years ago, we got 2.0 at Disneyland. And it is a phenomenal show. It is visually striking. I mean, it looks better than any of the other versions of Fantasmic. But I dare say, I, as an engineer, I kind of went, it's, you know, it's 2017, 2018. Okay. It looks great, but it didn't have that, how in the world was it done? It seemed like you could figure out how it was done because it relies on projection mapping and the world of color fountains, right? I mean, now you went from having an array of, you know, a dozen or so fountains to half that, because they could mimic everything that was done before, and they can do more, and now they can be any color at the, you know, changing of code, right?
And any angle and all that, yeah.
So Tim, what's your impression going from, let's go from Fantasmic 1.0 to 1.1, because you've spent time at both parks. What was your impression seeing the version here?
I worked
here
in
at
both
Disney
parks.
World?
Okay, a couple of things that I liked about the Florida version was just, you know, it was more comfortable. I did enjoy the Pocahontas scene quite a bit. I thought that was really cool. The shooting the dragon thing is fun with the sort of the cage of fountains that they surround them with. I like that part.
It looks better. The fountains there look better. But again, they're a little more linear, a little more control.
Something I thought was a little goofy when they wrote the Florida version was they tried to cram so many villains in there. So, and they would rapid fire them. Each one of them would get like a second and a half of screen time, and then you switch to another one and another one and another one and another one. And it's like, all right, I'm getting villain fatigue. You know, it's like, you know, if five didn't scare me, 10's not going to, you know? So it's like, it's just a little overdone as far as that was concerned. Let's see. Yeah, the Pocahontas scene. Obviously, coming from Disneyland, the Steamboat Willie scene is a huge letdown because it's you know, so much more dramatic with the Mark Twain.
Mark Twain, yes.
Yeah. And even though the Pocahontas scene is really good, the loss of the Peter Pan scene was you know, kind of sad too. There's something about those giant moving stages coming, you know, so close to the audience.
Oh yeah, actors swinging out over the river and all that fun stuff.
Yeah, that whole aspect is very dramatic, where you know you can practically reach out and touch them. They're so close to you, as opposed to being more of a distant arrangement in Florida. So, I also once they did the new dragon in California, I thought that was amazing too, which was kind of an intermediate step. But yeah. That one took
version 1.0a.
Yeah. That was really cool though. When you see the old dragon that they still have in Florida, it just kind of reminds you, you know, just a head on a stick, a giant puppet.
Well, and the mystery in Florida is like, where'd that dragon come from? Oh, there's a big mountain there. Yeah, it's a little bit.
Right. Well, that's the other thing is, you know, you expect to see trapdoors and whatnot on a stage. And they make it very clear in Florida that that's a stage. Whereas in California, it's not supposed to look like a stage. It's supposed to look like an environment. And it is, because you can hang out on it during the day. And it just doesn't look like a stage. It's so well disguised.
Watching setup, you know, the tech crew in Fantasmic was always fun. The light towers just come out of the ground.
Right.
And they were flipping over boats and barrels and exposing all the gear and tech out there. And, you know, it was cool to watch. And you're like, this is...
Yeah, the light
so
towers
unique.
Even. Just seeing those the first time. When those giant things start rising up, you're like, what the hell's going on, right? Like, where'd they put that thing? Because you can visually measure that it's below the water level, you know? Yep. So it's like, how'd they do that, you know?
And everything in Florida is below the water level. So, so Allie, going from version 1.1 in Florida to seeing 2.0, which do you like better? And which makes you as an engineer go, ah, this is the show for me?
Definitely the one in Disneyland, just because of the space that they fit everything into. And as a structural engineer, you're like, where did all this go? How do you build it? Where are the foundations for everything, like, in this small area? Where are you keeping the crew? All of that. Obviously, Disney World setup is nicer with the seating and the arenas. And I agree with you, Tim. I loved the Pocahontas scene when the canoes all came out. That part really struck me, that I remember the most from that show. But I think just, when I was in Florida, the dragon didn't really like strike me as something that was cool. Like, it's not like this memory that I have of that it was impressive by any means, because everything else around it is so big too.
That's part of the problem with that dragon, isn't it? Because you're sitting in stadium style amphitheater seating. You're looking down on it as opposed to Disneyland, where it's taller than you.
Right.
Because you're down on the ground.
Yeah. And then you get there to Disneyland and it is there, and it's a focal point with everything else that's going on, and Mickey seems pretty high up. So I think Disneyland 2.0 is the one that I would like better.
It is, from a show perspective, it's amazing. It is truly an awesome show. Again, it's just, as an engineer in my heart, it didn't tug at my strings. You know, it was difficult to see that transition from 1.0 to 2.0. I did want to talk about
a big reaction at Disneyland was the Pinocchio scene.
Yeah. Yes.
People it's always cute. Really like, where did that come from? Right.
Yeah. Pinocchio. I love those, the color changing strings. And of course, in the original version, they didn't change color. They just turned on off and on. It wasn't until later that they changed color. So I wanted to talk about a couple other shows that made me go, wow. World of Color is one that makes me go, wow, from a thematic point of view, from a just somebody watching a show. From an engineering perspective, the fountains are impressive, but because it's just a grid, I feel like it's painting with pixels. It's like a TV.
Yes, let's see. Yeah, visually very pretty. There's not a ton in that show that leaves you thinking how they do that. You know, there's a couple of cool effects, like during the Wally scene when they have the comets flying around. Yep.
The lasers through the fountains. Yes.
Yeah. Where you're looking at that and you're like, all right, how is that? Oh, that's cool. I get it. Okay. It takes a second to figure that one out. But,
and I think that's the key, is it's that how they did it moment where you, like with Fantasmic, I hate going back to this all the time, but given the day and age, the limits in technology, still this kind of analog to digital transition. I think the audio track was digital, but it's this being able to accomplish that show with the limitations of the fountains we have and the lighting, you know, incandescent bulbs that were sinking underwater, film projectors, the first time we're projecting on water screens, all of these things that were just firsts, or pushing the existing technology so far and making them work together. And then you go to World Color and it's like, this is amazing, but it just seems doable with not as much work.
Like something you could simply buy.
Yeah. You're not
as opposed to something that required a lot of, you know, amazing thought to make it work.
It's that engineering that, I've got to do what with what? Like, this little thing's got to be able to, okay. And then to the story writers and the producers' credit, now you have very limited fountain effects, limited color palette, and I got to make something striking with it. And they nailed it. It's just that the tool belt was so much smaller that's what impresses me so much.
Right.
I want to talk about Light Magic.
Yes.
The failed parade of 1997. Or was it 98? I can't remember it, but I was there.
It was pretty good.
I was there the first opening weekend for that one. And while the parade didn't do it for me, the fiber optics on Main Street, I will forever remember seeing Main Street transformed by, it didn't look great during the day. It was looked like Main Street needed a shave because there were all these little
hairy
pinpricks of fiber sticking out of the building.
Yeah.
But I would have been happy to see the parade go and to leave those for decades, because to see the facades light up, and Allie probably doesn't have a clue what we're talking about.
I've seen YouTube videos of it.
Oh, good.
The parade portion. I mean, they were not great quality videos, so you can't see the light. So
25 years ago.
VHS.
Yeah. Yeah. So the parade itself was, not great as far as that goes.
There was one effect. There's one of the buildings on Main Street has this giant circle up at the gable end. And there were these kind of seashell shape, they circles that trailed in, and it had this light pattern of just lights circling in, and it was mesmerizing to me as a kid that you couldn't see the fiber optics during the day or at night, but then suddenly when they turned on, there was this just swirling light effect. And like Pinocchio has another great fiber optic, the fireworks in Pinocchio.
Yeah.
And what I love about those is, you know, now you can take fiber optics and basically put them up to a projector or a TV and control them like pixels. I'm thinking like Indiana Jones, the fiber optics that were added to the tunnel as you go in there with the stars. But these that sit on like wheels with light, you know, colors, gels, and a light fixture that you got to kind of program the disc. And you're not undoing it. You're not changing it very much.
No, it's all hardwired in.
The thought and I built one of these as like a 14-year-old or 15-year-old kid. I built this swirly pattern with multiple colored gels, and it's really hard to figure out how to line up those fibers. And you know, if you put these ones in a line, they're always going to be the same color as that disc passed over it. So you're locked, you're committed when you build it. And I believe Light Magic was built on the same principle.
Yep. Color wheels.
And it's just amazing that you can produce something like that that is timed and synchronized and looks gorgeous. So that's one that's impressed me. How about air launch pyro?
Yeah, which is something that basically Disneyland had to do because of air quality requirements. They wanted to get rid of the smoke associated with sending one of those shells up in the air like that.
So we got the environmental benefit. What are the technical benefits of air launch?
Well, that they also put the detonator, just a microchip detonator that's synchronized with the rest of the show. So you're not reliant on a fuse. There's an electronic detonator that rises with the shell that gives you much better timing. And it's the one thing I'll point out to people. I'm like, pay attention to how well the music cues and the explosion of the fireworks are synchronized, because that can't be done without that system. It just doesn't work as well.
So another show patent, right? The air launch system. And what I always loved is that it was made freely available because of the environmental and safety implications of that.
Oh,
patent.
Did they? I didn't know that.
Yeah. And so, you get precise launch control, precise altitude launch control. And I remember, so we transitioned from Fantasy in the Sky, which had been on for decades, right, in different forms, to Believe.
Yes.
And, of course, Tarzan had come out that summer, I think, or that fall, and was heavy on that music, so that was great. I remember the first time I saw the synchronized Mickey firework, where you got the big one and the two small ears pop out of there. And, of course, since the big shell is larger, it's got to cover more space. It bursts first, and then all of a sudden these two ears pop out. And you're like, how in the world do you send three shells up and get that perfect geometry?
Right.
And there are nights it's not perfect. But the first time I saw it, it was dead on. And then you get the close pyro that's now able to be launched from the castle and Matterhorn and all those things, because you take that explosive at ground level out of the equation. So that to me has been a phenomenal tech that just made me go, wow, to be able to do that with air, compressed air, send a shell up. So yeah, Allie, do you have
that show Believe was the first of its class, really, that ended up becoming still the standard at Walt Disney World and Disneyland, where they've added, you know, the projection mapping particularly in Florida, but also, you know, in California. It's a really good show system that other places just can't pull off. You know, it works really well.
Absolutely. So, Allie, you've seen quite a few of the pyro shows. Do you have a favorite one?
I do. It no longer runs, but Wishes at Florida was my absolute favorite.
Because Wishes was really good.
First time that I had saw the mapping projection on the castle. And to me, that was just, I was 15 at the time too, so I had no idea how. I mean, I had an idea of how they did it, but the fact that it was coordinated so well and precisely to the castle's measurements just was awe.
And that's projection mapping when it really started to hit Main Street. I'm thinking, so Wishes is Right is a derivant of the 50th anniversary fireworks. And then we got the fireworks show that Tim and I can never remember the name of, which is Remember at Disneyland.
Right.
It came back. and that's when Disneyland made the switch, because the 50th anniversary had very limited castle effects, to the projection mapping. And that Generation 1 projection mapping is that phantasmic moment where you're like, oh my goodness, you can do whatever you want now.
Remember that was on It's a Small World in California for Christmas.
Yes.
That's when they really worked it out.
And so I will get giddy anytime I can see the castle dance. That is just the coolest effect to me. Watch it like sway back and forth.
I was like, yeah.
And then now
seeing, or when the tower launches in the middle.
Yeah.
Now seeing Happily Ever After at Disney World, which is an incredible show, and the fireworks take a second, you know, they play second fiddle to the projection. That show, from a visual standpoint, awesome. It's another one of those, it's like World of Color. That is amazing. It is perfection. From a technical standpoint, you go, okay. I've seen projection mapping, and now I like watching things blow up in the sky too. So I'll go watch it. I love it. It's my favorite thing, one of my favorite things to do photos of it at Disney World.
I think part of what you're getting at is practical effects versus projected effects. And that is something that I think people come to the parks for, because they can see so many great effects just at home and through their computers and stuff like that. So what we really have to emphasize in the parks are you know, the practical effects. There is a thing, a figure, something moves, things like that, as opposed to just making it look like it.
And that's really the heart of Disneyland, right? We can go to movies. We've been able to go to movies for a long time, but being able to go to a place that makes you feel like you're there. So I'd like to close on then this last show. It's actually a Universal show. It's the Bourne Identity stunt show that just opened this last summer. Oh. And I saw it a couple months ago, and it's visually striking. It is it's in the old Terminator Theater, which I never saw the original show there in Florida. But the screen is huge. I mean, it wraps around the audience, and it's a really good venue. And it's extremely high quality video that you're seeing in there. And the interactions between the live actors and the screens are seamless, really well rehearsed, really well thought out. And I was really impressed with the show when I walked out of there. And then I started to kind of play it back over my mind. And the one complaint I had is it was a one or two note production. It was like fight, fight, fight. Chase scene, fight, fight, fight. And they did some cool things. And then I started thinking about the Indiana Jones stunt show. Or right. Even the car, the lights, motor, action
lights,
show.
Lights, motor, action.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Where it was physical. There was fire. There were things blowing up. The backdraft show at Universal.
Right.
Where you're there in it, and it's hitting on a bunch of notes and a bunch of feelings, and it's not just visual. How different that makes you feel. In backdraft, you literally sweat, right? Because it's just so hot. And now that I've known enough fire protection people to kind of get an inkling for what they deal with, it's amazing that show could ever work inside of a building like that. There's a lot of great shows out there, and I'm not knocking the visuals. I'm not knocking the story, and I'm not knocking it as a production. It's, again, what I do as an engineer, I want to see how in the world did you make that happen?
I do like it when those sorts of effects are kind of more secondary. A good example of that was when Islands of Adventure put out Spider-Man originally, when the park first opened. because the combination of practical effects and visual, you know, projected effects is really top notch in there. You can't tell where one begins and the other ends. And I think that's kind of the where it finds its best use.
Absolutely. Well, wonderful. I have one last question, and we won't spend much time on this. What is a product that we use every day or often, it's a common product, that if it had not been invented yet and was invented today, couldn't happen, couldn't go to market because it'd be too dangerous or the liability
cars.
Would be too great? Tim says cars. That's I think that's a no-brainer. Absolutely. Yeah. Allie, do you have one?
Bleach as a common household item is pretty toxic and dangerous, but we all use it to disinfect. So
bleach and Drano. Yeah, those two. Mine's a straight razor. You're gonna go take this blade across your face and neck. I feel like that just couldn't happen today. So thank you for indulging me on that. I always like those fun brain teasers. But cars, if we knew how many people were going to die as a result of vehicles, I think it would be a tough sell. Yeah. Even though they save a lot of lives and make life much, much better. I agree. Holy. Well, thank you for joining me this evening. I appreciate it, Allie and Tim. It's always nice to get to chat with you. This has been The Wrinkled Engineer, and I hope you've enjoyed our podcast today. Have a good one.